Thank you, Steve. It is Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It's WGN Radio. An important topic we're going to discuss. There is a new book called The Education of Brett Kavanaugh. And, Bill, you pointed out that it's been a year since
Hard to believe, but it is. It's a year.
And before that, I didn't know who Brett Kavanaugh was.
Mm-hmm.
We have two New York Times reporters and authors of the new book in the studio with us. Robin Pogrebin.
Yep.
Okay. I asked you, and I was worried about that. And Kate Kelly, thank you so much for coming up, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
All right, reporters, you guys were pretty instrumental in getting some information that we all heard, including, and I don't remember how to say, was it Renata?
Renata Schroeder, yes.
Yes.
The woman who was the subject of the yearbook shaming at Brett Kavanaugh's high school in the 1980s.
And you were, how did you get this information? Were people talking to you? Did they want to talk to you?
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. So I'm a Wall Street reporter normally, and Robin's a culture reporter. But I happen to have been born and raised in the D.C. area, and I went to an all-girls school that was kind of in the same loose network with Kavanaugh and others who figured in this saga last year. And so I got an incoming call from a guy that I had known growing up, did not actually even realize that he had gone to Georgetown Prep, Kavanaugh School. And he said, you know what, you need to look into something. And it turned out to be this Renata story. And basically, it was that there were references throughout Brett Kavanaugh's senior yearbook, published in 1983, to something called the Renata Club on his personal page, in other personal pages, in group photos. And essentially, what my tipster and then others we talked to on the record and on background told us was that they were all kind of bragging about having had, you know, sexual encounters with this young woman who was actually a friend of theirs and
Poor
has stayed
girl.
In touch with some of them to this day. But yeah, they liked her as a friend, but they also, you know, found
Friends
her attractive
with benefits.
And they were bragging about her and even put it in the yearbook. So this was something that kind of went to the mindset, maybe, of those young men at that time.
Right.
And it was kind of informative because, of course, we were dealing with allegations that Kavanaugh had assaulted a young Christine Blasey, who was 15 at that time, and he was 17. The idea that there was this sort of casual misogyny as one of the alumni of that class that I spoke to described it was kind of relevant.
This is an infuriating defense, but it's one I know you both have heard. He was just a kid. He didn't know what he was doing. He was a young guy at the time. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, we have definitely dealt with that, and we do in our book, which is there are very different schools of thought on his behavior,
yeah.
Whether or not it took place or not. I mean, it is alleged behavior. And those who feel that what something someone did when between the ages of 17 and 19, they should not necessarily be held accountable for 36 years later. We thought it was important to report out whether or not this was a pattern of behavior, whether this did seem to be there was a history of sexual predation that perhaps we could report out. That's not what we found. We found the allegations of Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez both credible for reasons we detail in the book.
Yeah.
But there is a real debate about whether or not what somebody does as a youngster when their brain isn't fully formed is something that shapes them for the rest of their lives and should prevent them from serving on the Supreme Court.
Should
That's
that
just
have
it.
Been pushed more, though? Don't you think that should have been a little bit more front and center?
I think there are those who feel that his temperament on
yeah.
the day he testified on September 27th, and when it was very belligerent and self-righteous, was more egregious even than the allegations themselves,
yes.
and that was disqualifying for the Supreme Court. It spoke to a lack of judicial temperament. It indicated a sense of political partisanship because
yeah.
he blamed the Clintons, and he also seemed somewhat unhinged. There are also those who argue that if he was fighting for his personal and professional life, you might be able to understand that kind of exercised emotional response, and that they had never really, those who know him well, say it was anomalous, that they didn't usually see him behave that way. He
well,
was
and that,
typically
of course,
very mild-mannered.
That was his own defense, right? So he wrote this kind of apology essay in the Wall Street Journal in the aftermath of that and before the vote on his confirmation was taken and said, look, I was thinking of my parents, my two daughters, my wife, you know, and I was very frustrated and emotional about what they were going through. So, you know, that was his attempt to kind of explain it.
Another point that's important to make is that people felt that if he had had a more human response,
yes.
Maybe I did some bad
yes.
stuff when I was young.
I was a stupid kid.
I was an idiot.
What, yeah.
I feel I drank too much.
Yes.
I'm sorry if I hurt people. I don't remember doing it, but something more empathic, that the whole world would have responded differently. On the other hand, the president, who was the client, who could have
yeah.
pulled his nomination at any time, it probably would have disqualified him in Trump's book when pugilism is the, you know, the operation of the day. And he wanted him to deny, deny, deny. That is the Trump strategy. He wanted to see Kavanaugh employ it.
Being a Supreme Court justice, though, is a job that almost insists that you have sort of an even keel, and he didn't seem to have one then.
What's interesting and a little bizarre is that for temperament, he was very well known and respected for years and years.
Yeah, right.
He had a very good rating from the American Bar Association that was actually pulled in the aftermath of those outbursts. And clerks who had worked for him, whom we talked to and we saw speak publicly, and other, you know, colleagues, fellow judges and so on, said he was a super even-keeled guy. If you go back to that week, that particular week, it was late September of 2018, where he had that hearing toward the end of the week. But earlier, there was this sit-down interview with Fox, with his wife, Ashley, where he was super, considering everything, super calm, simply just said over and over again, I want a fair process. He, of course, denied the allegation, said this never happened. If this stuff in college that was alleged happened, it would have been the talk of campus. But I just want a fair process. That, from what we're told, was much more the real Brett Kavanaugh. But of course, as Robin just alluded, you've got a president who's all about fighting, and his attitude is, when it comes to accusations of sexual assault or harassment, deny, deny, deny. He has said that. You have an environment in which it's just so polarized, and this issue is so triggering for people with both sort of pro-Kavanaugh and pro-Ford perspectives, as well as other perspectives. It just seemed like he had to keep up the confidence of those who were backing him up. And, you know, he was told by the White House counsel, as well as the chief nominations staff member to the Senate majority chairman, committee chairman, you got to come out swinging. You got to reboot the room. Show them how emotionally affecting this has been for you.
But also, to your point, you did have Justice Paul Stevens say, I did support this guy.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I can anymore.
Yeah.
You had a lot of law school professors saying, you know, this takes him off the table, that kind of temperament is absolutely inappropriate. He can't possibly be objective going forward,
right.
Impartial.
Right.
And if it wasn't true, then it is a shame that he misses this opportunity. But listen, you can't be responsible for what you do when you're 17. I have an almost 17-year-old son and a 20-year-old, and I said things are different from when I was growing up. Boy, people would have some interesting Snapchat photos of me at parties in high school and stuff, but now you have to worry about that. And I just am still shocked that he just didn't come clean and say, you know, I don't remember this, but maybe I did do something like that. We're stupid kids. It just split the country, and it was so frustrating to me. We had it on here. We're walking up and down the halls. Everybody had a comment. Why would Christine Blasey Ford bring this up if it didn't happen?
Sure, and what you're getting at, and Robin got at with the apology that wasn't, you know, that's the thing that I think many of us as just human beings, you know, kind of wanted to hear, something that would sort of acknowledge that Dr. Ford and, you know, some of these other women had been through something terrible. In Kavanaugh's view, something had happened to Dr. Ford, but it was not him. Maybe he could just say, you know, there was heavy drinking back in the day, and I regret if anybody ever got hurt. But it's just this very tough political climate, and we see it playing out with the impeachment proceedings right now. It's a similar playbook in a way to what some of the empowered conservatives did during the Kavanaugh hearings. It's kind of like, pick some factual issues that can distract or detract credibility from the witness. With Ford, it was like her fear of flying. Perhaps she's exaggerated her fear of flying because, after all, she flew here and she's flown to other places and things like that, that are not really the core issue and don't go to whether or not she was assaulted, but kind of cause a seed of doubt. And then, you know, essentially try to harm the credibility in that sense and make it seem as if it's a witch hunt. You see that going on with somebody like Marie Yovanovitch or even Bill Taylor or George Kent last week. And it's unapologetic. It's the same strategy.
But also, to your point, I think it's interesting that we had these Yaleys come out of the woodwork saying, you know, wait a minute, this is not the Brett Kavanaugh we remember. He drank excessively. He was stumbling drunk. It's perfectly conceivable that he was blackout drunk, that they did call him out. They felt that that was really meaningful dissembling or lying about his past behavior. And they thought that spoke to his credibility and potential for a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court.
He mentioned a lot that he loves beer. I don't remember any other Supreme Court justice mentioning anywhere close.
No, but what you actually recall is that there was Justice Ginsburg, Douglas Ginsburg, was disqualified for smoking pot years ago. So we have come to a different place where, but even, you know, just giving the slightest concession, you can't give any ground because perhaps that they'll take you off the table.
Well, if you go back and watch the hearing tape from September 27th, you'll notice he gets his most angry and animated and kind of rivalrous. When he's asked about the blackout theory by Senator Klobuchar, famously, and then he did apologize for that. But there are other moments. There's a moment with Senator Whitehouse. There's a moment with Rachel Mitchell, the prosecutor who was questioning on behalf of the GOP. Yeah. He gets really angry about the blackout questions. Maybe, and this is our theory, we kind of talk about it in the book, because that's something that would have stitched together these accounts and made both sets of accounts true.
Yep. We're talking to the authors of a new book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh. If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All right. We are back in action now with Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, reporters, both from the New York Times or various different places.
Both from the New York Times, yes.
And, of course, authors of The Education of Brett Kavanaugh. It's, you know, I'm thinking of him denying. He didn't want his wife, his kids to know this. In a weird way, that's why I try to be a good individual, because you don't want this information to come out where it does embarrass you in front of your family. What have we learned from this investigation now? Anything?
That's a really great question. I mean, I think we've actually learned it's important to look at public opinion, because we get asked a lot on the road about the Anita Hill hearings in 1991, especially with Joe Biden running for president and what's changed. Public opinion has changed. Even after the Hill hearings, and although they left much to be desired in terms of corroborating witnesses who were not called, et cetera, the majority of the public wanted to see Clarence Thomas confirmed, according to polls around that time. The results were flipped this time around. A majority of people polled, and there have been two separate polls with similar results, one last December and one in September of this year. A majority did not think the Senate did the right thing in confirming Kavanaugh. 6 out of 10 respondents said they would support an investigation into all of the allegations against Kavanaugh, according to the recent poll, with just 39 opposed. And Dr. Ford was considered more believable by a double-digit margin. So you see that between the Me Too movement and other trends, people are really taking these allegations very seriously and would like to see action.
But we can't do anything about it.
Wendy, that what one of the issues you raise is that people do feel a sense of impotence around this, and that there is what it speaks to more than anything, than aside from the substance of these allegations, is that we are at a moment in our culture where no one is really listening to each other, where minds are closed and not open, and that we have intense political polarization where people are in their corners and they stay there, and they had their minds made up before this even began. They caricatured these people who were involved. They didn't really want to learn more and try to understand the facts on the ground. That's why we return to this subject. That's what we try to do in our book, is explore this in depth. We come away saying that we probably satisfy no one, because we do not serve any particular agenda. And what you see, you saw during the hearings, and you're seeing even with the publication of our book, is people, you know, pulling out various aspects of this story and deploying it for their own purposes. And that's the moment we're in, and that's hopefully a moment we can try to move past, because it certainly doesn't seem to be serving anyone.
I want to ask you how he was received by the other Supreme Court justices, but not that long ago, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said positive things about him, said he's a pretty good judge.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I mean, I think that he's basically, there is this sense that once he's on the court, he's going to be welcomed. They often disagree with one another, but they are something of a cohort, and you had Ruth Bader Ginsburg have a very close relationship with Antonin Scalia, for example, even though they were at opposite ends of the spectrum. And I think there is a real, they also want to get each other to vote with them, I mean, to basically come down on the and convince one another of their arguments. So I think that is informing the relationship as well, and everyone's taking the high road.
Yeah,
I think two things that are worth keeping in mind going forward. I mean, one is, and we talk about this in more detail in the book, Kavanaugh is actually a little bit of a less predictable jurist than people may realize. You know, there are certain issues issues, and some of them he's already had an opportunity to opine on the high court, and there will be more to come. Some of these issues, like pro-choice, the right to seek an abortion, and also LGBT rights, for example, the ban on transgender folks serving the military. He's been somewhat predictable on those in terms of, you know, essentially making it more difficult in one case, or agreeing that it should be a little more difficult under the proposed regulations to seek an abortion in Louisiana, and, you know, backing up the president's moves on transgender folks in the military. However, there are some areas where he may be more of a swing voter or a surprise to people who have a certain set of expectations around him. On executive powers, he actually praised the decision that forced the Nixon tapes to be turned over and made public during that era. He said that was a very courageous decision. That'll be interesting to see as we go into this phase where the court, you know, for example, they're being asked to weigh in on the issue of Trump's taxes, but almost certainly they're going to have to weigh in on some of the impeachment-related matters. And, you know, there are other areas in which he's been a bit of a surprise. So that's interesting to note. And the other thing is, you know, the Lindsey Graham perspective on this. Mm-hmm. You remember his outburst from last September. Is, you know, if you win the election, you get to put people on the Supreme Court. So to the extent people are upset about this, they should be motivated to, you know, kind of get involved in this election cycle and make sure their voices are heard one way or the other.
Supreme Court justice is a job for life. Is that in our best interest, do you think?
There are certainly those now who are challenging that, and this has raised questions, as well as perhaps increasing the number of judges, justices on the court. I think there is some reevaluating going on. You had, when our book was published, six Democratic candidates calling for Kavanaugh's impeachment, although that seems probably unlikely. There is a sense that the degree to which this is finished business is unsettling to a lot of people, and I think there is some real thinking going on about the fact that you can't sort of dislodge these people once they are in place, and they are going to be making decisions. This has been the strategy of the Trump administration, is to appoint as many federal judges as possible, and they're doing it to an amazing degree, and that's going to be his legacy that lives well beyond his terms.
Right.
You say unfinished business. Will we ever know what happened?
I think we answer a lot of the questions in our book. That doesn't mean that we have definitive up or down information on, you know, yes or no, this particular thing happened or this particular thing didn't. I mean, there's much more corroboration for the college allegation by Deborah Ramirez, which we could talk more about. And in terms of Dr. Ford, you know, what we tried to do for our readers is something we wanted to see ourselves, which is make the phone calls, knock on the doors, look at the layouts of homes in Montgomery County at that time that she thought might have been the venues. And that doesn't mean that everyone agreed to be interviewed by us, but we tell you what they did say. Like, we talked to her friend Leland Kaiser so many years later about her perspective on what may have happened. We talked to Mark Judge, the friend who was allegedly in the room. You know, the houses where this could have occurred, we narrowed it down to two places that we thought were likely, although it couldn't be firmly established. I think more information is knowable, but without subpoena power and without the relevant parties feeling obligated to give more information, be more sort of forthcoming about not just their memory of that event, because they've said basically to a person they don't recall it, and then a Kavanaugh has gone so far as to totally deny it, but just to say, tell us more about the culture at that time, tell us more about Kavanaugh as a young man. And we do that in our book. We kind of give you a picture of a good student and an athlete and a fairly well-liked guy who nonetheless, you know, drank heavily along with many of his peers and could become a different person under the influence of alcohol or while trying to impress his friends. And so in that sense, we've tried to kind of stitch the narratives together, but there's much more we could learn.
That is Kate Kelly talking, and Robin Pogrebin. You guys have congratulations on this.
You.
The Education of Brett Kavanaugh. Best place to get the book, really, wherever books are sold, correct?
Yes, correct. Please buy it.
And you're in town for a couple of appearances. These are not open to the public?
Well, we're going to be at the University Club in about an hour and a half, and that is open to the public. You have to call the book stall in Winnetka, or maybe you could show up and get a ticket. But we're doing that, and I think everything else is is kind of closed to the public, but we'd love to hear from folks on Twitter or, you know, on our author page at Penguin Random House Portfolio Imprint if you have feedback for us, and we really appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. Can't wait to read it.
Congrats on the book, ladies.
Thank you so much.
All right. A little break, Wendy, and then more show.
Then coming up, the news, too, from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. It's all happening right here, 720 WGN.